If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Sorry for interrupting. This is Dave, Content Director on HistoryExtra.com. I just wanted to mention that we've produced an exclusive 8-part podcast series called The Princes in the Tower, a Medieval Murder Mystery.
It contains kind of everything you want in a mystery, doesn't it?
It's kind of a fairy tale. There's an element of the Brothers Grimm to it.
It's the story of a downfall of a royal family, the House of York. It's the fall of a young, innocent king full of promise.
It's got potentially gruesome murder. It's got, you know, that kind of heartstring pulling element of the fate of children.
That is the irony. You know, you needed to be a ruthless man, really, to be an effective king.
Obviously, no, The Princes in the Tower is the great mystery of the medieval age.
We ran the first episode on our podcast feed on Tuesday, the 6th of October. And you can find the rest of the series on our website at historyextra.com/princes. Now, you'll have to register to listen in, and registration options may differ by territory. But once you're in, you'll be able to listen ad-free and to access a wealth of other great content about the princes in the tower, medieval and Tudor history, and all other aspects of history as well. So do please head over to historyextra.com/princes to check that out. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today we have a conversation about the great turning points in early medieval Europe. Dr. Charles West from the University of Sheffield is our expert guide, and asking the questions on the cultural, military and social transformations of the era is our content director, Dave Musgrove.
Dr. Charles West is reader in medieval history at the University of Sheffield. His interests concern the history of Europe between the 7th and 12th centuries, and his current research focuses on 11th century Europe, on which he's writing a book for Oxford University Press, and it's provisionally titled Between Reform and Revolution. Now, I follow Dr. West on Twitter, and I noticed an interesting tweet from him a while back where he was talking about the choices he was making for a new course he was putting together for his students on medieval European history. And the approach was to look at it via a series of turning points. And the moments he were choosing, they sounded fascinating. So I thought it'd be good to get him on the podcast to talk us through the selection and give you all a very brief taste of European medieval history as well. So firstly, Charles, thank you very much for joining us. I hope you're well.
I'm very well. It's great to be here, Dave. So thank you.
Good stuff. So firstly, I thought we could have just a quick chat about the process of putting together an undergraduate history course. And if anyone's listening to this and think that sounds a bit dry, don't worry, we'll get to the straight history in a bit. So bear with us. But I think this will hopefully be interesting. So firstly, what is the time span for medieval in this case for your purposes?
So I'm taking a pretty broad approach to it, Dave. I mean, this is really part of a wider curriculum, which goes from Rome right up to the present day. And I've kind of got charge of the medieval content. So I guess I'm taking that really from the fall of Rome right up to, up to the Renaissance and the 15th century.
Okay, so 5th century to 15th century, something like
that.
Pretty
much, yeah.
Yeah.
Great. The medieval millennium.
Okay, so that's a lot to cover, isn't it?
It is. And of course, as you said in your very kind introduction, I'm kind of focusing on the 11th century at the moment, but it's very nice to kind of be forced out of my little research corridor or silo to think about some of the bigger pictures.
Sure. So how does it work in terms of planning a course like this? Presumably you're given a basic criteria or set of things that you need to talk about.
Yeah, I think the key thing to this is that this is a European history course. Okay, so it's about medieval Europe. And the challenge for that is what we've been briefed to do is think about how to teach the history of Europe, of medieval Europe, without being Eurocentric about it, okay? So it's not about, you know, the history of the triumph of Europe or a celebration. It's kind of thinking critically and thinking about, the experience of minorities, the experience of diversity, questions of pluralism. So kind of taking a more... historicizing the idea of Europe as well, actually. So thinking, Europe isn't actually a monolithic block. People have had different experiences, different times. And of course, the medieval millennium is a very long period of time. So there's a whole range of experiences in there which could be included. And the task of this sort of course, I think anyway, is to try and get at those as an interesting and enlightening way as possible.
So let's talk about turning points a bit. So the approach of using turning points as a way to understand history and particularly the medieval millennium. How useful are they, do you think, as a way in?
I think they're great. I think the key thing is to remember that, I'm not actually arguing, and it's not necessary to argue that in each of these turning points, history hung in the balance. It could have gone either way, right? I mean, for some of them, that is the case, but that's not necessarily the case. Really what I'm using these turning points to do is to think about change, think about processes of change. And these are kinds of ways of thinking about that change in concrete, specific terms. Okay, so kind of pinning it down to places and people in particular, times.
So it's more sort of pivotal moments maybe than turning points.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are turning points. Maybe we'll come on to that. And there are, of course, there are many which could be chosen. But yeah, and, history doesn't always change as we know. I mean, sometimes I say it does hang in the balance. Things could have gone either way, but usually really significant change comes at a slower pace.
The first one you've chosen is, as you said, this is European medieval history. So we're not just talking British stuff, and that will come through quite clearly. So the first moment is the year 596, Pope Gregory I's mission to the English. Now, that kind of that probably might feel like we're on home ground for some of the listeners. This is like the familiar story of the reintroduction of Christianity to England amongst these sort of pagan Germanic settlers who've come in. Now, that's obviously quite a contentious thing to say it and a way to say it. So I imagine you're gonna be approaching this in a very nuanced way. So what's your line on this?
I mean, that's right. I mean, I think so. As you said, this is European history. It's not English history. Obviously, this is a big moment for English history, a really big moment, but I'm more interested in it for its European dimensions. And I guess the point I want to get across with Gregory the Great's mission to the English is really twofold. Firstly, I think Gregory's a very interesting figure because having said that this is a course about the medieval millennium, Gregory is often considered really as part of late antiquity. Okay, so I guess I want to get across the sense to which historical periods are made by historians. The Middle Ages is not a thing which defines itself. We define it. And actually, some historians have argued quite powerfully that Gregory the Great, he's not really part of the medieval world. He's really part of the kind of antique world, okay, a kind of prolongation of the ancient world, which is called late antiquity. And that's because his mindset is really still imperial. He still thinks in terms of Roman Empire.
What is the difference between the late antique and the early medieval? What's the how do the mindsets alter?
That's a great question. I think it really depends. Different historians will give you different answers to that. I think it really depends where you're looking at Gregory from. So I think it makes a lot of sense to look at Gregory from the perspective of Christian Rome, the kind of the Rome of Constantine the Great and so on, and thinking forwards. If you're looking at him backwards, it becomes more early medieval. He really sits on the cusp, okay? He can be thought of as both. I think the way in which it is about his... It's really about his conceptual frame of reference, as I said, and the way in which he kind of is still part of the ancient world in terms of thinking, in terms of empire. But he's also, to some extent, thinking beyond that, right? And actually, his mission to the English is a critical part of that. The English were not, the people he thought of as English, were not really in the empire anymore. You know, I mean, Britannia, the island of Britain, of course, had been part of Rome, but they'd been lost to the Roman Empire. It wasn't really under imperial control. And Gregory, he sends missionaries to them anyway. Yeah, so he's kind of still thinking in imperial terms, but at the same time also thinking beyond them.
What was his base reason for doing this? Why did he want the English to be, coming back into the fold?
So two reasons for that, and I think this is the key question, really. I think the first is that he knew that they were pagans, so his knowledge of Britain is very shaky, in fact. He knows very little about it. I mean, one of the funny things about this is that he sends this mission to the English. He talks about the English, the Angli. But the person who actually receives the mission, so this is King Athelbert of Kent and his wife Bertha, probably wouldn't have thought themselves as English at all. And lots of historians have written about how Gregory the Great, by sending a mission to the English, actually kind of promotes and to some extent creates an English identity. And he does that primarily because he thinks they're pagans, which they are. And he's also, of course, worried about the end of the world, right? And there's a kind of injunction in Christianity to convert the whole world. And Gregory's very aware that the end days are coming, right? He doesn't think he's going to see the end of the world himself, I think, but he thinks it's coming, you know, pretty soon.
What would Ethelbert have considered himself to be, do you suppose?
That is a great question. It's almost impossible to answer that question simply because we don't have any writings by Athelbert himself. Usually people, I mean, if we go by the ideas promoted by Bede, Venerable Bede, I'm sure will be familiar to many of your listeners, Athelbert was king of Kent, which was a Jutish kingdom. Whether Athelbert thought of himself as a Jute is at least as likely as him thinking of himself as an Angle. He probably just thought of himself as king of Kent.
Okay. So, but the really interesting idea then is this mission actually starts to bring about the formation of an English identity, which is quite a sizable moment. Then
I would say this is interesting for European history too, not just English, because I think that's a really interesting one of the. Which we're getting at earlier, contrast between the Roman Empire, which is, you know, massive hegemonic non-European political institution, and medieval Europe is populated by independent peoples, right? Independent peoples who most of whom have been Christianized, and there's a really strong link between Christianization and this kind of ethnicization of politics. Okay, so in the Middle Ages, we've got the English, but of course you've got the Bavarians and Lombards and the Poles and the Hungarians, and they're all kind of essentially independent groups. So the Christianization process, I think, helps cement that ethnic fragmentation of Europe, if you like.
Okay, now this is far too big a question to ask, but is this the start of the process of the development of nation states and politics?
That is far too big a question for me to ask quite right there, but... I think we need to be treading really carefully here because there is the risk of the English are not a nation in the sixth or seventh centuries, but nationalism when it comes builds on a kind of idea of politics which is broken down into peoples. So it's a separate process, but I do think it kind of builds on what's there already.
Let's move on to 711, the year 711, and the establishment of Al-Andalus. We're going to Spain, we're going to Iberia, and the point is that it's a reminder that Europe was not always or exclusively a Christian land. So just drop us into what's going on here.
I mean, that's absolutely right. This is central. We do often at the back of our minds, I think, have a sense of medieval Europe as a Christian place. And there's some truth in that, but in important ways, it's not true at all. Al-Andalus is, for example, I mean, Definitely by our standards, part of Europe. And actually, I would argue in the Middle Ages, lots of people thought it was part of Europe too. There is always a geographical sense of Europe, right? The world is divided into Asia, Africa, and Europe. And medieval contemporaries did think of Iberia as part of that. And of course, it was Muslim. Not the only place. Of course, Sicily, also Muslim for, between the 9th century and the 12th century. And actually, even in the Eastern Europe, Hungary had a substantial Muslim minority population. So I guess this turning point for me is all about making sure students realize that, you know, there have always been Muslims in Europe, and there has always been an Islamic Europe, I guess.
And so 711, what specifically happens there?
So this is the invasion by Tariq ibn Ziyad, who leads an army across from North Africa. And he fights the Visigothic king, if I remember rightly, Roderick, and he defeats him in a pitched battle. So actually, this is one of those turning points, actually, where, you know, if that battle had gone differently, things might have turned out differently. What happens then is, I mean, it's a surprise victory. It's quite a massive victory. It's not clear that Tariq was actually meaning to go and kind of conquer and set up a new political unit of Al-Andalus. It was probably a raiding party. And there's been lots of discoveries recently of lead seals, which seems to have been used to seal up bags full of booty, which have extracted as the army then continues its march further north.
The Muslim kingdom is established there, and it lasts for a very long time, doesn't it? Is it? It's 7 centuries thereabouts.
Yeah, 7 centuries. I mean, I think it's most people would say it flourishes most in the 10th and 11th centuries. So it's in the 10th century that Al-Andalus is probably the most politically powerful state in Western Europe. And 11th century, actually the moment ironically of its fragmentation, it kind of splits apart into different little mini kingdoms. But this is a moment of a kind of cultural blossoming, really, of kind of court poetry and court architecture. And, you know, the kind of golden days of Al-Andalusi culture. And it's also really important, it's around this time too, that some ideas from the Islamic world more broadly get kind of filtered through into the rest of Europe. So good examples of that are the number zero. We start to see that in 10th century, almost in Northern Europe, almost certainly coming from Spain, the abacus as well. And there's always been discussion about architectural influence.
Yeah. So does it become the conduit for this Islamic knowledge and by
it does. I mean, it's worth studying
the antique knowledge as well.
Absolutely. It's worth studying for its own sake. And of course, I'd also say that some of the knowledge which is being transmitted is not ancient knowledge. It's actually, you know, Arabic Islamic knowledge where they've kind of built on the ancient legacy, and that's being passed through. But yeah, no, it is absolutely a gateway. And that actually continues through into the 12th century when Christian European ideas of Islam are usually based on what they know of Spain. The first Quran, for example, to be translated into Latin in the 12th century, well, that comes from Spain.
Okay. And you're going to talk about this concept of convivencia in your lecture as well. So perhaps you could just tell us a bit about that. And I think that's about the interaction of Muslims and non-Muslims, right?
Yeah, that's right. So it's this notion that, and this is one of these things where I think it's useful to bring in a bit of a debate that historians have had about the past. So for a long time, Al-Andalus was considered complicated historiographical reasons, but it was considered this place of, you know, where it was possible to have Jewish and Christian and Muslim communities all getting on pretty well, all right. That's quite controversial these days, actually. Historians are no longer sure that's a good model for thinking about Al-Andalus. It wasn't, you know, we can't see anything which we would think of as a modern kind of toleration, but it does seem to be a bit of a contrast of what we can see of Christian medieval Europe.
So the idea of a tolerant society has perhaps been overplayed a bit in the past, and now there's a bit of a rethink about that.
Yeah, that's right. But it's still, there is, you know, there's no doubt that there's kind of more cultural diversity. There's a cultural diversity in Al-Andalus, which would be difficult to match in most of the rest of Europe.
Okay. So you've talked about Judaism as well in that, and we're going to come back to that in some of your other turning points. So I'm just wondering, before we move on, how far do we understand how the Christian nations perceived Al-Andalus?
To some extent, there was curiosity. To some extent, there was also some hostility. We might come back to this later, but some of the rulers north of the Alps actually start to explore diplomatic contacts with the Caliphate of Baghdad, precisely because they have a kind of common enemy. So there is some sort of There are some military confrontations, but not all the time, right? As you said, I mean, Al-Andalus, it's around for seven centuries. It's not in a state of constant warfare, right? This isn't a kind of Europe which is constantly at war over religious questions.
Was there a general fear of expansion of Islam from Iberia?
No, there's a wonderful text actually I've been looking at where Frankish monks in the 9th century go and collect relics of recently martyred Christians, actually, from who've been recently executed for blasphemy. And Christian monks from the north go and collect these martyrs, and they're very excited to have these relics, and they're not very interested in Islam at all.
Okay, brilliant. Right, should we hop on again another century to 802? And this one sounds great. The elephant arriving in Aachen in Germany. And so we're into the time of Charlemagne now.
We are. So this is a slightly quirky choice on my part, I must confess, because it would be more obvious, really, to go for the coronation of Charlemagne in the year 800 as Roman emperor. I mean, that's the classic choice to make. But I thought, let's talk about this elephant instead. And actually, it's not so much a different topic as it might sound. Charlemagne's crowned as emperor by the Pope in Rome on Christmas Day 800 because he's already a really important person, right? And actually, the elephant which is sent to him from the Caliph of Baghdad, Harun al-Rashid, that's another kind of recognition of his importance. So they kind of go together quite nicely.
Well, you kind of think medieval Europe and medieval Christendom is all encased, and the only contacts beyond it are to go and have a fight in the Crusades and that sort of thing. And that is clearly not the case, is it?
No, that's a really interesting point, because actually there are two things I want to stress here, and I'm going to stress in this lecture. Firstly, and this is I'm relying here on a brand new book by Giuseppe Albertoni, who stresses that Charlemagne didn't just get an elephant, he asked for an elephant. He actually sent messengers specifically saying, I want an elephant. And the funny thing is, I mean, we don't really know what Charlemagne then did with his elephant. He seems possibly to have tried to use it as a war elephant against the Vikings. That's where the elephant dies in 810, having been kind of wandering around Aachen for, you know, good nearly a decade. And I don't know what the Vikings would have thought about being faced with kind of one solitary elephant rushing towards them as they're on their boats. But he does really want it. And what's interesting about that is actually that until quite recently, that elephant has been kind of written out, because Charlemagne, he was called by a contemporary father of Europe. He's often kind of thought of as a key figure in European integration and things like that. In the 19th and 20th centuries, he was seen often as a Germanic hero. What was he doing with an elephant? I mean, you know, it didn't really make sense. And if you go to Aachen today, there's a wonderful set of 19th century pictures of Charlemagne put together to kind of, you know, imagine what life must have been to kind of evoke that picture. You can look as hard as you like, but there's no elephant there, right? They didn't want to imagine their Charlemagne, this kind of European figure, as not only having an elephant, but actually having requested it.
So he was looking for a war elephant. He wasn't looking to build a menagerie of exotic beasts or anything like that.
There's been some discussions whether he had a menagerie. Later kings, of course, did do that. You know, polar bears and that kind of thing. He's Charlemagne. Does like wild animals. He mostly really likes killing them, I think. He does. He likes hunting a lot, right? He spends a lot of time hunting. So I don't think this elephant was playing around with the giraffes and so on. I think it was probably pretty much on its own. But.
Right. You're probably not an authority on pachyderms, but presumably this elephant would have been a very unique and exotic creature in the 9th century.
I think we can safely say that most people in Charlemagne's Aachen would never have seen an elephant before. And actually, we can kind of show that, because there are some wonderful pictures of elephants. And you can quite clearly see in some of them the differences between people who have seen an elephant and people who have not.
They said that he might have been using it as a tool against the Vikings. Now, the Vikings, they're not in your... in your list here. You haven't got 793 and Lindisfarne or anything like that. So, how are they gonna feature in your lecture series?
I think possibly just like that. Actually, it's interesting though. I mean, I was we can maybe talk about other points I might have talked about the Vikings and other kind of missing things from my little list. I did though think quite hard about the Vikings and the Scandinavians' discovery of Northern America. Okay, so the settlements in North America around about the year 1000. There's a wonderful, I mean, it's recorded in sagas. There's also been archaeological traces are pretty clear, and there's a wonderful discussion recorded between an Icelandic woman named Gudrid and a Native American. It's very kind of Their conversation is very short, but it's very evocative, right? And it's the only kind of record we have of the European conversation with an American for 4 centuries. And Geraldine Heng's done some really great work on that. But in the end, I thought, Year of the Thousand Vikings, the settlement didn't last long. In the end, I thought probably more important has to be questions of unfreedom and slavery. And so in the end, you can't do everything in a course like this, sadly.
How important a figure is Charlemagne in the course of medieval Europe?
I would say he's a pivotal figure, yeah. I think he has been politically instrumentalized for a long time. Until recently, as I say, he's been kind of stressed as a precursor to the European Union. I think that doesn't work for all kinds of reasons, not least because, you know, he is he's extremely violent, right, on occasion, which is not necessarily the model you want for European integration. But I think he is quite a pivotal figure, yeah, in terms especially of rethinking the ancient past. Okay, so, I mean, he does, in a sense, set up the Roman Empire again, even though obviously it looks entirely different to what it had been before.
So let's move on, and we're going to the year 1000 and the end of slave society, which is probably quite important. So slavery and that side of social life is a very interesting and hotly debated topic. And we talked about the Vikings there, and the Vikings, a lot of their raids were, I think, predicated on the idea of getting slaves. And Neil Price's new book on Vikings talks quite heavily about that and stresses that a bit more than perhaps some other studies of the Vikings have done in the past. And there's a sense that maybe in England particularly that you get the sort of the Anglo-Saxons were a slaving society, and then the Norman Conquest comes along and that ends it. So I've probably got that completely wrong, but where are we? I mean,
these are all fair points. I think, though, the distinction we need to make, though, is between societies with slaves and slave societies. Okay, so you're quite right. In the medieval Europe, there was always chattel slavery. There are always people being trafficked as slaves who might be uprooted from one community and sent somewhere completely different. And, you know, for them, there must have been thousands of these personal and familial tragedies. In the wider context, though, medieval Europe is not a slave society in that while there are kind of people who are chattel slaves, especially, by the way, I might add women. So women seem to have been disproportionately affected by this kind of slaving. That is not the main form that unfreedom takes. In most of Europe, most people were unfree to some extent, but it was a very fluid concept, and they weren't—they were not slaves in the sense of which you've been talking about.
Okay, so what would happen in the year 1000 or thereabouts to bring about the end of that society?
So the key question here is this distinction between slavery and serfdom. Okay, so on the one hand, we've got slaves, and you know the Roman idea of slaves. I'm sure you know very well. A slave is not an enslaved person; is often not treated as a person at all. They're owned by their enslaver. It's kind of as simple as that. The serf in medieval Europe is very different. Legally unfree, but has lots of kind of legal protections at the same time, right? So, I mean, a classic example is in the Roman Empire, slaves were not allowed to marry, so their marriages were not legally recognized. In medieval Europe, of course, serfs could marry, right? And that was a kind of recognized union and bond. And the key question is, when does one become the other, right? When does slavery become serfdom? And the problem here is that it's kind of the same word in the sources for both, so it's not obvious. Yeah, the Latin word servus means both slave and serf. It depends on context. So this historian called Guy Bois argued some time ago that really we should start to interpret the Latin word servus as meaning serf around the year 1000. So that's why I've chosen that as my tipping point.
And is that a sort of a European-wide development?
Yeah, it is. I mean, Guy Bois argued, particularly in the context of France, and I guess I should add very quickly now that almost no one believes him anymore. There was a little bit of debate about it, which is why I'm setting it as my turning point. But the idea that there's a sudden moment when that happens is probably not widely acknowledged now. People would say it's more complicated than that, as history normally is. But it is certainly European-wide, yeah, and that sense in which, you know, all across Europe and, you know, up until the Black Death anyway, most people are in a vague state of unfreedom, some more than others. Some people, of course, might be more unfree, but also richer. Yeah, so status and legal status were not necessarily as tightly connected as they often had been under Rome.
Okay. And does this, you mentioned women there, so does this also speak of gender divides and different ways that that sexes were treated in this period?
Yes and no. I think on freedom, I mean, chattel slavery often seems to have affected women more than men. That's partly because the demand for chattel slavery was often domestic, as opposed to the kind of classic Roman plantation slavery, where enslaved peoples would kind of do all kinds of things, work in the fields, you know, build all those, you know, all those amazing Roman monuments, which still survive, the Colosseum, aqueducts, so on, were built in part using slave labour. That's very different from the medieval world, right? The cathedrals and all that medieval monumentality, you know, did not have, was not reliant on slave labor in the same way. So that meant there was, you know, the chattel slavery which there were often affected was often more domestic and thus tended to be more directed at enslaving women. So there's definitely a gender dimension to this.
What would have been the religious view to all this? Does the church, I mean, you one imagine the church would take a dim view of people being unfree, but do they
not as unfree,
chip in on this?
Yeah, not as dim a view as you might expect. There was always a diversity of opinions. So there were certainly some Christian authors who thought, the conventional answer to that was that slavery and unfreedom, it's a result of sin. It's not a natural state of affairs, but we are where we are. Right. And, you know, anyone can get to heaven, and that's, you don't need to have a kind of, you don't need to be free in order to be a Christian. So the church kind of made its peace with unfreedom quite early, although they say there were always critics within it.
Is before we move on, the idea of slavery, the concept of slavery, obviously abhorrent to us today. Is that one of the biggest sort of disconnects between medieval society and modern society, do you think?
I guess so. I mean, I would say it's a bigger disconnect between modern society and the ancient world, which was entirely happy with slavery. Obviously, the slaves were not happy with slavery, but the enslaved owners, there's very little criticism of slavery in the ancient world. There is more in the medieval world. I mean, rulers often, for example, get upset about Christians being taken as slaves. They kind of, in fact, they have legislation to try and stop that happening, in order to, you know, so yeah, they've got the very clear sense that Christians should not be slaves. So we do get a sense of, you know, they're not abolishing slavery. This isn't abolition, but they are kind of more, I think, attuned to how problematic it is.
Should we hop on, or have you got any more?
No, I mean, I guess I'd just, I mean, that is, I think it's a very interesting point that often we kind of think about the modern, the age we live in now as we kind of, we see the links with the ancient world in terms of, I don't know, sophistication of the economy, in terms of law, in terms of all those kinds of, in economic terms too, but actually the modern world we live in has, it seems to me, and this is kind of one of the points I'm trying to think about, there are lots of resonances of the medieval world too. I think the world we live in today is actually closer to the medieval world than to the ancient world.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And there's this very famous moment reported by several chronicles where essentially they take the town by luck, and they pause because they say, there are heretics in this town, but how do we know who's a heretic and who isn't? And famously, the papal legate, who's called Arnaud Amalric, says, kill them all, God will find out his own.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear.
the luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Right. Now, I fool myself that I know a little bit about medieval history, but and some of these points I had to read up on a bit. But the next one, I've got to admit, I was completely ignorant of it. So 1058, the Pataria in Milan. And it sounds a bit niche to me, Charles. This was fighting on the streets in Milan in 1058 over the issue of clerical sexuality. That seems quite a specific thing. So you're going to have to help us out on that.
Yeah, I guess so. This is one of those points where I'm using this not to say that history, you know, this is a hinge point for European history in this particular moment. It's more a kind of way of thinking about some wider issues and wider changes. I mean, it's a big moment. He lived in Milan, and of course, Milan was one of the growing cities. Late in the Middle Ages, it would be one of the biggest European cities. What's interesting for me, though, is precisely that it is a growing city, okay? And in the 11th century, we start to see towns and cities growing in a way which they hadn't done before. And that means you've got substantial urban populations, and that brings with it problems of governance. So the Pataria, that revolt in 1058 in Milan, is, you know, it's been called the first appearance of the crowd in European history. We get these people running around, thousands of people, and they can't really be controlled. No one's in charge.
Again, I was on this podcast, I'm chatting to Ryan Lavelle, who's got an interesting book about insurrection and rebellion during this period. And his point is that there isn't the rebellion and insurrection tends to be from the aristocracy or the higher ranks of society arguing for their position. You don't get so much sort of crowd disturbance. But and I guess that speaks exactly of what you're saying. You know, this is
exactly.
The Peasants' Revolt is 1381.
Quite simply, to have a kind of crowd situation like that, you need a concentration of population. And that is quite new in 11th century. Towns had never totally gone away, but there'd been pretty small affairs in the early Middle Ages. Not, of course, in Islamic Europe. So Cordoba is a big city in the 10th century, but that's organized on different lines.
So the biggest cities in the 11th century, where are they? Are they in Italy or where do you find them?
Yeah, they'll be in Italy. I mean, Northern Italy is Northern Italy, and actually the shores of the North Sea. I mean, Cordoba is still, you know, some of these Spanish towns are also still pretty big, but we're getting this great upward trajectory, especially in cities like Milan. Rome is still, of course, never to be neglected, right? It's not as big as it had been under Rome, shadow of its former self, but that former self is still, you know, it's still something to be reckoned with. But Milan, yeah, that kind of the Po Valley, I guess, and the North Sea coast, places like Ghent and Bruges.
Yeah. London, how would London compare, do you think, in this?
London's on there. I mean, it's interesting. By the time, you know, not long after this, of course, is the Norman Conquest, which isn't on my list, as you probably noticed. But the Norman Conquest gives us amazing documentation. We kind of, through Doomsday Book, we see that actually lists quite a lot of towns. And we see, you know, England's got about a dozen significant towns with a few thousand people, but they'll be smaller than Milan.
So another ludicrously large and impossible to answer question, but so you talk about this as the dawn of crowds but is this people power? Is this the start of people power? Is this the start of democracy?
Certainly not the latter, no. But I think we can. What is interesting about this is how towns end up being integrated into the wider political system. So. Lots of work on this is in the shadow of Max Weber, that 19th century sociologist, and he has this idea that European towns are different because they're autonomous. They're not very well integrated into, you know, kings don't rule towns very strongly. I think that's been, you know, in England, I'm not sure that's really the case, but in Northern Italy in particular, you do start to see places like Milan becoming effectively independent. That's more the 12th century, but they become these city-states. Right. Now, they're led usually by the bourgeois, right? It's not being led by the rabble in practice. It's not being led by the people. But we do see these are new actors on the political scene. Yeah. Alongside your bishops in the church and the kings and the aristocrats, we see cities and towns, and they're starting to play a new role. And that's kind of complicates 12th and 13th centuries onwards. That really complicates the European political map.
Okay, so we need to take note of urbanism as a medieval social changing force.
Yeah, and also, you know, as a kind of place of different experience. Mary Rubin's just written a new book, just in time for this lecture, on being a stranger in towns, because, you know, this was a place where there were strangers. There were people coming to towns you didn't know before. That's quite different, really, from the rest of the countryside, where you're kind of living in your communities, right? And there will be people coming in from elsewhere from time to time. But cities are kind of places where, you know, there are always strangers.
Just on that point, before we move on to the next one, I mean, as you said earlier on, obviously this is changing all the time. You know, scholarship is developing and changing. How hard is it to keep up with all this? Because, you know, there is obviously you've got 8 different aspects of things going on here, and there will be 10 academics at least writing something on that right now on each one. So it must be hard to...
Yeah, it's hard. I think what's interesting for this is finding topics which I have got recent historically, so it's this, you know, I want to have topics where the students can really get in and find out more about it for themselves, all right? So I don't want to kind of set up a topic where basically if you look into that, you can't find anything else about it, that I've said all there is to be said. So it does take a lot of time actually to find the right readings, you know, which are kind of interesting, accessible, pitched at the right level for the students. And, you know, as you say, updating it is a big task because history keeps on, it keeps moving on, right? People do keep writing on these great new books.
Yeah, which is good. Right, we're going to skipping past 1066, as you said. We're moving on from that, and you're going to 1096 and the Rhineland massacres. Now, this I mentioned Judaism earlier, and when we were talking about Islamic Iberia. So this is Jewish persecution, and I guess our listeners from Britain will be familiar with stories of persecution of Jews in England a bit later on than this. Probably, you know, the major incident. So what's going on in the Rhineland?
So what's going on here? This is often seen as, I mean, it's kind of tied up with the First Crusade. So what happens is, as armies or groups of crusading, you know, people heading off on the First Crusade towards Jerusalem, as they pass through Europe on their way, as they pass through the Rhineland, some of them seem to decide, you know, well, we're going to fight the enemy, you know, in Jerusalem, but why don't we fight the enemy right here, right now? And there are some very vicious pogroms, I guess, or kind of assaults on the Jewish communities, especially in the towns of Mainz, Worms and Speyer, which are all basically in the Rhineland. And there's some harrowing accounts of Jews being forced to either convert or to die. And some of them many of them choose to die. And there are awful accounts, in fact, of suicides and martyrdoms, of mothers killing their children to avoid the fate of being forcibly converted. So it's this really kind of awful episode. And I think actually, you know, I've chosen this rather than kind of classic 1099 capture of Jerusalem. I think you can't understand the First Crusade, the motivation of the Crusaders, without understanding what happens in 1096 in the Rhineland.
Mm. How significant or sizable were these Jewish communities there?
They're fairly sizable. I mean, we're talking of they're quite young and new, right? So there haven't been sizable Jewish communities in this area until quite recently. I mean, talking of the Norman Conquest, for example, it seems there are no Jews in England before the Norman Conquest. So they're kind of, these communities are growing in the Rhineland. So they're still fairly small. But, you know, we're talking of the thousands, right? So we're talking hundreds of victims. So proportionately very, very high.
I guess this goes to the heart of the question of Christian Jewish relations. Why were they chosen? I mean, just religious, or were there sort of economic issues underlying it as well?
I mean, it's interesting. One of the great things about this awful topic is that we've got Christian sources where we talk about it, and we've also got Jewish sources where we talk about it. So there are some accounts, there are some chronicles written by Jewish contemporaries and near contemporaries, and they kind of, so we've got, we can see this episode through two lenses, so to speak. And while, you know, there are, I'm sure there were economic underpinnings, this was nonetheless driven primarily by religion. The persecutions are being carried out by people who are not actually from the towns of Speyer, Worms or Mainz. These people passing through, yeah. And in fact, to some extent, the bishop, for example, the bishops of these towns offers limited protection to the Jews, sometimes more or less successfully against these marauding armies who are just coming through looking for victims.
Mm. So, would it be wildly inappropriate to describe this as a crusade?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think. I think, yeah, this comes to the question of exactly what the First Crusade was and what its intention was, which is very difficult to say because I'm sure you know all the major sources of the First Crusade are written after it succeeds, right? So we've got very little sense of it, or it's very hard to work out what exactly the motivations of these of the First Crusaders was, because so much of it is written up after they manage remarkably to take Jerusalem. So I think this is a really interesting episode. This gives us an insight into what the crusading motivation was. And this kind of this, you know, a deep and really unpleasant intolerance is on display here.
Mm. And I mean that takes us back to Al-Andalus, doesn't it? And the idea of tolerance that you were talking about there. So sort of another big question: medieval European society, tolerance, not tolerant. To what extent was toleration a thing?
I mean, I guess it comes and goes. And the same is true. I mean, there is also anti-Jewish violence in Andalus as well, although usually not quite on this scale. I'd also say, you know, this is often seen actually as the beginning of persecution of Jews in Europe. So, you know, in Jewish scholarship, especially since the Second World War, this has been seen as the first acts a sequence which ultimately goes to the Holocaust. So this is seen as, you know, this... almost like a new period in Jewish history. I think there were moments of tolerance. I mean, the Middle Ages, as I said, I'm taking it as a millennium. It's not the case that everybody is at each other's throats all the time, but every so often this rears its head, this intolerance, often directed at Jews. And it's often quite essentialized too. So later on, you know, Jews might convert to Christianity, but they're still regarded with lots of suspicion.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's a kind of, you know, and some people, and I guess, yeah, let me mention Geraldine Henge here, says, you know, we can kind of see the roots of modern ideas of racism in how the Jews are treated.
Yeah, yeah, and that's a absolutely fascinating piece of work from her on racism and where that forms. And she talks about the Crusades a bit as well in there, doesn't she? I mean, that kind of moves us on to this to the next point, 1209. Your title here is Europe, a Persecuting Society, and you're talking about the Albigensian Crusade. So... again, we're in a different sphere here. Obviously, we've moved on quite a long in time, but you better just explain what the what was going on in southern France.
Yeah. Okay. So this lecture's. I mean, I'm afraid it's another massacre, right? And I'm kind of aware there's lots of violence in these lectures, which is in a way regrettable. But what this is about is the massacre at Béziers. So this is a famous episode. What happens is the Pope Innocent III has called for a crusade, and for the first time, this crusade is not against an external enemy; it's against an enemy inside Christendom. Not as happens with the Jews, kind of an unexpected consequence, but this was deliberately aimed at people within Christendom. So it's aimed at the heretics, the Cathars in southern France, and. What happens is the crusading armies arrive looking for heretics. They seize this town. Well, they besiege this town of Béziers. And there's this very famous moment reported by several chronicles where essentially they take the town by luck, and they pause because they say there are heretics in this town, but how do we know who's a heretic and who isn't? And famously, the papal legate, who's called Arnaud Amalric, says, "Kill them all. God will find out his own." Right, so this is kind of, you know, this doesn't really matter who those heretics. If you just kill them all, then the right people will go to heaven and the wrong people won't.
That's quite a sort of a disputed statement as to whether that
it's apocryphal, but it's noted already in the 13th century. So I guess this comes to, I mean, what I'm using this turning point to indicate, it's about heresy. It's about heresy. Mm. And it's about attitudes to heretics and the way in which Christianity, you know, or at least Latin Christendom, so Christian Europe kind of turns not just against the Jews, but also tries to find an enemy inside, an enemy within.
Yeah. Is it easy to explain just exactly what it was that these heretics believed?
It is not easy at all. In fact, it's almost impossible. I mean, one of the problems is, and this is actually why I'm chosen this point as well, is there is a debate raging as we speak about whether there really were any heretics at all, or at least whether the heretics were really constructed by the church. Okay, so the church is looking, is it the case the church is going and looking for people who have heretical beliefs and then finding them? Yeah, or are there indeed actual people, you know, missionaries from Bulgaria or from further east who are coming in and actually constructing an anti-church? And I think it's, in some ways, you know, debate reminds me a bit of debates about witches in the early modern period. When we see there's a growth of kind of witch, anti-witch persecutions, we don't generally say, well, there must have been more witches.
Yeah.
Right. And in the same way, we see this kind of focus on finding out and rooting out and destroying heretics. But we can't necessarily assume from that that's because there were more heretics. It might just be because the church is trying to find them more.
Sure. So where do you stand on that quite contentious debate?
It then? Is contentious. I in this lecture, I will probably just kind of present it as the choice for the students to make. And I tend towards the idea that this is a construction, actually, and that the church is looking for people who are heterodox. So people who maybe, you know, aren't doing exactly what the most educated clerics think they ought to be doing. And they're reading that heterodoxy, that kind of difference of practice. They're reading that as heresy when it really kind of wasn't, or at least, you know, for the people who they thought heretics would not have thought of themselves as heretics.
Right. So that's the line taken by R.I. Moore, is that right?
That is, yeah. And I guess, yeah. I mean, R.I. Moore was a predecessor of mine as a historian in the University of Sheffield. So I guess I'm following the party line on this.
Yeah. Okay. So to understand that, you need to read his works on
yeah.
That,
and in some ways, this is a key. I mean, I said this course is really all about thinking about plurality, diversity, experience of minorities within Europe. R.I. Moore's concept of the persecuting society is kind of a really important aspect of that. The idea that this is a society which is organized around identifying and persecuting outsiders.
Mm. I think you've just answered the question I was just about to ask, but I'll ask anyway. So, so why was medieval society so worried about heresy? Why was it such a big issue?
I think, yeah, it's interesting. And I think it's nuts in two ways. I mean, some people would say this is a kind of, it's always convenient. I mean, it's to have a war on heretics. It's a convenient political tool. So if you want to kind of attack, in this case, in the Albigensian Crusade, the Count of Toulouse, you know, call him a heretic or a defender of heretics, and you've got a kind of ready-made discourse there to attack him. I mean, I think also there is, I mean, that makes it sound too cynical, I guess. I think there is also, genuinely, there is an anxiety about difference. There is an anxiety. There is a genuine anxiety that you know, all around there are enemies, and they need to be. We need to kind of control that and master this situation. I think that is a genuine issue. I think what R.I. Moore says, of course, he links it to the rapid changes which Europe is undergoing at this in this period, especially 11th, 12th centuries. We're seeing massive social change, you know, the emergence of towns. I've talked about already. This kind of new clerical elite is being formed, and I think, you know, he would say there's a kind of attempt to define and reinforce boundaries.
You know, okay.
Who's in, yeah. Who's out.
Okay. I'm going to hit you with another massive question, which is another stupid thing to ask. But I mean, I've asked this of a few medieval historians over the years, but you've pointed it up there about cynicism versus genuine belief, I suppose. How Christian was medieval Europe? How much did people genuinely, truly believe in the Christian faith, do you think? And obviously, you can't answer that, but, you know.
I can't. I mean, it's a massive question, because obviously the problem is that depends on what you mean by Christian. I'm sure. So, my position on that is, I think most people regarded themselves as Christian, whether or not they would have matched the standards of you know, set by clerical elites in cathedrals and monasteries. I don't know. And of course, the other question is, you know, were people kind of constantly thinking about theological questions every day while they go about their lives? Of course not. Right. So, I am. This is by the 12th century. What we're seeing is this is definitely the institutions are Christian, the education is Christian. This is a Christian kind of society, except for those parts of Europe, of course, which are not Christian. I think the real question is, how important was that Christianity to people's daily life? How conscious are they? Are they kind of, you know, how devout are they? And that's a very different question. I think some people are very pious, and some people are much less pious.
Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. Okay. It's clearly an impossible question to answer, but thanks for having a go. Right. We're going to move on to the last one, the last point. And again, a very black one, the Black Death, 1348, a topic that I guess right now we're all terribly familiar with. Everyone's using it as for making parallels and comparisons with COVID-19 and that sort of thing. Clearly, it's a very important moment. Clearly, lots of people died. What are you going to be saying there? What are you going to be telling your students that that maybe they don't know about?
I mean, this is a massive topic, isn't it? And I think you're right. There's been so much now on the Black Death because of that parallel. It seems impossible to avoid, but there's also so much to read. Monica Green has, for example, put together, an American historian, she's put together a 96-page bibliography now on the Black Death, which you can look at. It's available online. It's just a lot of material. I guess there are a couple of points I'm going to make here, I think. The first is, to emphasise the huge death toll. COVID-19 is bad, right? But it's not as bad as the Black Death, right? Which, estimates have changed over time. I think these days historians do tend towards a pretty apocalyptic interpretation of it, right? About 40% of people are thought to have died in Europe in the 1340s and 1350s. And then, as you know, it keeps on coming back. Let's hope that doesn't happen with COVID-19. So I guess the first point is to emphasise that. The second point, of course, is coming back to that point we've talked about a few times. This is not just a European disease, right? It's a global pandemic. Yeah, and the Black Death comes to Europe through probably the kind of trade routes which are themselves being promoted, the Silk Road kind of trade routes themselves promoted by the Mongol Empire and things. So, the Black Death, it's a bit like Charlemagne's elephant, right? The plague bacillus is another kind of illustration of how Europe was definitely integrated and part of that wider world.
So clearly it's brutal, isn't it? That those sorts of numbers are terrifying in comparison to what
they were terrifying for people. They were terrifying for people then. I mean, I've talked about harrowing accounts of the Jewish persecutions in 1096. There are equally harrowing accounts of the kind of scale of death, right? And there's these terrible letters. There's a lovely set of sources translated by Rosemary Horrocks, which I always get my students to read, called The Black Death. And there are letters in there by English bishops. And they know that the Black Death is coming because they can see it kind of creeping its way along the continent. And all they can do is say, well, we just have to kind of pray and hope it doesn't come. And of course it does. The implications, though, of the Black Death are still being discussed, really. Economists, bizarrely, well, maybe not bizarrely, tend to think of it as, in the long run, a good thing, right? They tend to say, well, this increases social mobility, it kind of concentrates capital, it causes wages to grow as well. I'm not sure that would have been much of a consolation, though, for, in 1348, as you think of the long-term potential benefits.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that there are various societal, economic, political changes that have been attributed to the Black Death by historians in over the past. So what are the main areas of change that you would suggest devolve from 1348?
There are two, really. I mean, there's the economic ones, and of course they play out differently because in Eastern Europe we don't see the kind of economic benefits in the next century or two centuries that seems to happen in Western Europe. So I mean, broadly speaking, fewer people tends to give immediate. The decline in the number of workers tends to mean that they can command higher wages, and they do. And of course, lords and the elites try and stop that, and there are all kinds of laws. I mean, my favourite examples are you get sumptuary laws, so these laws regulating the kinds of clothing you can use. You get a few of those before the Black Death, but a lot more afterwards. And essentially, they're trying to stop people who they think ought to be poor wearing fashionable elite-style clothing, and it doesn't really work, of course. And you also get, this is the age of your right of peasant revolts. And what's interesting here is that what seems to be going on is that, these lords and elites, they are trying to stop the poorer classes of society from benefiting from their new leverage, And when they try and stop that, that's when you get revolts and rebellions.
Right, okay. Well, that basically takes us, those are your eight moments. We've talked a little bit about some of the ones that didn't make the cut, and obviously there's hundreds of years that you could have chosen. Literally, are there any? If I had to say, which was the one that you thought, oh, I wish I could have got that one in as well. If I had a ninth lecture, what would you?
I don't know. I mean, I think probably because there was quite a lot of debate on this, and people made various suggestions. I mean, one point, for example, is that I've got very little in my list about Byzantium, and I admit that, and it would have been nice to have, for example, the Battle of Manzikert, although I've probably got enough battles already, or maybe the 1054 supposed schism between East and West, and actually, was that a schism? And that can be debated, but it's a moment when we can see tensions between the clerical elites in the emerging Latin Christendom and in the old Eastern Roman Empire, which we call Byzantium. Would have been really nice to put that in, just because, there's a Byzantium is part of Europe too, right? And it doesn't feature as much as I think it ought to in my list. And I was taken to task on that on Twitter, rightly so. I also would have liked to have put in, there's a wonderful, in 1070, this was actually on my list at one point, a man called Constantine the African arrives in southern Italy. He's from North Africa and he brings with him great cartloads of books, Arabic books, which he proceeds to translate, and they're all medical books. Okay, so that moment he kind of brings in with him the most up-to-date Arabic medical knowledge, and that gets translated into Latin very quickly, actually, and then spreads around the rest of Europe. So you can kind of see this transformation of European medical knowledge happening. And that might have been a nice contrast to all the kind of battles I've got. But in the end, you know, you have to make choices around.
What would you say the main themes that you think we should be aware of when we're thinking of medieval European history? Because as I've sort of made a point a couple of times, I think a lot of our listeners are probably very familiar with medieval British history, but not so much beyond these shores. So what should we know that we're not familiar with?
Yeah, I guess the first thing I'd say is it's really very difficult to separate out British history from European. I mean, my opening turning point on the 596 mission, I think, illustrates that you know, this is a key moment in English history without any question, and thus also for British history, it's very important. But it's definitely also a European historical moment, and only really makes sense in that context. But I think I'd say, yeah, I guess the key message I'm trying to get at is that, you know, we shouldn't take the idea of Europe for granted, actually. The Roman Empire, as I said, was not a European thing. It didn't really think of itself like that. And we need to kind of remember there's lots of plurality and diversity in medieval European history too. Right? I mean, that's obviously the case in Britain as well. But there's, and I really wanted to get at those that diversity, those experiences of minorities. Yeah, kind of, you know, when you admire these great cathedrals, which, you know, which people do, these the ones in England as on the continent, you know, they're magnificent, aren't they? But, you know, what would it look like if you'd been the peasant working for them, right? What would it be like if you're a Jew looking at these and thinking, you know, what you'd have a different point of view on them? And I guess it's that sort of diversity of, you know, I want to kind of represent and project that diversity a bit more.
Well, it sounds like an absolutely fascinating course. I wish I was one of your undergraduate students. It sounds brilliant. Maybe there are some people listening to this who would be thinking they'd like to do it. And I guess they can be applying for courses. I presume you'll be running this over the next few years. So
it will. I mean, it'll probably change as people, you know, so there'll be new books next year, right? So I'll have to keep it up to date. And maybe if people really have a go at me about Byzantium, I'll see if I can fit it in.
Okay. Well, Dr. Charles West from the University of Sheffield, thank you very much for your time. That's been a very instructive conversation. I very much enjoyed it, and I hope our listeners will too. I've learned a lot about medieval European history, and it's been a great pleasure to learn from you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Dave. Thank you.
That was Charles West. You can also read a feature by Charles about some of the key moments in medieval history on our website. You can find that at historyextra.com/medieval-turning-points. Thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in next on Friday when Andrew Bayless will be speaking about the Spartans.